Sorry, for talking to us this evening. The 11 o'clock news is coming up right now.
Of the UK
and the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 11 o'clock. This is Simon English. President Biden has said an all-out war in the Middle East must be avoided and that he'd be speaking with his Israeli counterpart, Benjamin Netanyahu. Israel has expanded its operation against Iranian allies, bombing Houthi targets in Yemen. The Israeli military said the port of Hodeidah was being used to transfer Iranian weapons and oil. Lebanon's health ministry says more than 50 people have been killed in continuing airstrikes on the country. Our correspondent John Donison, who's in Jerusalem, says Israel's been showing its far-reaching power by fighting on multiple fronts.
In Lebanon, in Gaza, of course, and in Yemen, officials are saying the number of people killed is 4, with 29 injured. Now, that is some 1,800 kilometres away from Israel, so the reach of Israel's military is long. They say these strikes were in response to attacks carried out by Iranian-backed Houthi rebels there.
Rishi Sunak has urged the Conservative Party to end the backbiting and the squabbling. In a speech on the opening day of the party's conference in Birmingham, the former Prime Minister said he had one final ask for members to get behind whoever wins the contest to replace him. A man who was arrested after the death of an 8-year-old boy from gunshot wounds in Cumbria has been released on bail pending further investigations. Officers were called out to a farm yesterday afternoon. Projections in Austria show the far-right Freedom Party is heading for an unprecedented general election victory, but the FPÖ is expected to fall short of the outright majority it would need to govern alone. Georgios Samaras, an assistant professor of public policy at King's College London, thinks other political parties will unite against the FPÖ.
At the moment, we have a party that's striking parallels with AfD, the German openly neo-Nazi party, anti-migration rhetoric, and of course, heavy Islamophobia. I don't think that FPÖ, despite its win, will find any coalition partners, as most liberal forces are poised to come together, NEOS, FPÖ, and the Social Democrats, to stop the far right.
In football, Tottenham are celebrating a 3-0 win over Manchester United at Old Trafford. Elsewhere, Aston Villa drew 2-2 at Ipswich. The Ipswich manager, Kieran McKenna, said despite the draw, he was pleased with his side's start to the season.
We've had probably, if you look at the table, a difficult first six fixtures. And again, it's four games in a row now that we have got a result out of the game. The only two teams to beat us so far are Man City and Liverpool in the first 2 weeks when we were really coming together as a group. So I think we're in a good way. I like the direction of the group, but we know there's a long way to go.
And the Hollywood star Damian Lewis has taken part in a medieval tradition by driving sheep across Southwark Bridge in central London. The actor described the custom, which is only open to those awarded the Freedom of the City of London, as eccentric, but said he was happy to be involved. And that's the BBC News. It's 3 minutes past 11.
Matt Shawley.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
We are looking for a member of Matt's Parliament for New Forest East. Mick has got a claim. Hello, Mick.
In 1997, I proposed in a little hotel. It was actually in the bathroom.
What?
We were getting ready for dinner and I wanted it all to be sort of sorted before we went in and celebrated.
Lisa Nadi, it's such a safe culture major as well.
We're toughening up the system to make sure that people who are unfit owners can't become football club owners.
Matt Shawley.
Monday to Friday from 2
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Stephen Nolan
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Well, tonight on The Nolan Show, we've heard from the Conservative Party conference. Reem Ibrahim from the Institute of Economic Affairs is there and says the mood is optimistic.
It feels as though there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of discussions about what the Conservative Party should stand for, what the ideology should look like, what the principles, what does it mean to be a Conservative. But all of it comes down to what the future of the party looks like.
Here's the man who lost the election, Rishi Sunak.
There is a brilliant buzz at this conference, isn't there? It's fantastic, terrific energy, thousands of you here.
We'll be hearing from the Conservative MP, Danny Kruger, in just a moment. He says the leadership contest is actually bringing the party together.
The conversations that have been being had between the candidates and within the party are constructive. There's a remarkable level of agreement about the problem we've got and the breach of trust we had with the public at the last election and the need to rebuild that through a different sort of politics.
And?
Ladies and gentlemen, we now ask for your attention while we take you through the safety procedures on this aircraft.
One of the stories really doing really well on the BBC website this weekend is about flight etiquette. So we'll take a look at the do's and don'ts of modern day flying. Some of the headlines tomorrow: the Metro shock cereal drink drive epidemic, the Express cruel winter fuel will cost NHS £116 million a year. The I, Israel targets Iranian weapons network in Yemen after wiping out Hezbollah leaders. We are all about your calls, so here's how to get in touch.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Call free 08085 909 693. Text 85058. Text will be charged at your standard message rate.
Visit bbc.co.uk/5liveterms
for our terms of use and privacy notice. Stephen Nolan
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Right, let's go back to the Conservative Party conference, shall we, where MPs and delegates from around the country are gathering in Birmingham tonight. The outgoing leader, Rishi Sunak, is urging members to end the squabbling and back whoever is elected as the leader to replace him. All four candidates, Kemi Badenoch, Robert Chenery, James Cleverly, Tom Tuganat, have taken part in hustings tonight. I've been speaking to the Conservative, Danny Kruger, the MP for East Wiltshire, who's supporting Robert Chenery.
Well, it's a good conference, actually, because people are genuinely having a discussion about the future of the party. It's a strange one because we haven't got a leader. Rishi was here today, but I think he's now left or leaving. And the rest of the conference is all about the leadership contenders. I'm backing Robert Jenrick. He had a very good day doing all sorts of events and media. So did the other candidates. I think the mood is positive and sort of interesting.
Do you think your party's demise, because you can't go forward until presumably you worked out what went wrong, do you think it was down to Rishi Sunak or was it down to the party?
Listen, it was all of us, I'm afraid, and it goes back long before Rishi. I'm afraid to say the fact is we as a party failed to deliver on the promises we made to the public at the last election, and we've had, you know, the comeuppance we deserved. There's lots we can point to that we got right and should be proud of. And there's lots of reasons why we struggled, COVID and Ukraine and the rest of it. But fundamentally, the public recognised that we made promises on migration, on the economy, on the NHS, that we didn't deliver. And we can point to different leaders and different ministers, but fundamentally, it was a collective failure of our party.
And why was it so widespread, the lack of integrity or the lack of honesty or the lack of preparedness to keep your promises with the public? What is rotten?
Well, I don't think it's that anything is rotten, but we failed collectively to deliver. And I think one of the reasons for that is that we weren't recognising how broken our public system is, the state itself, the apparatus of government. And it's our responsibility. We're not blaming the civil servants or anything like that. But my personal view is that after Brexit, we had a instruction from the public to fix the British state, to get the government working on behalf of the people. And across a range of issues like planning reform, which, you know, couldn't build the houses, NHS reform, we couldn't get the money to the front line, migration, we couldn't get the borders secure. We didn't do the job that the government should have done and that the public expected us to do. And everything else, important as it is, issues around personalities and scandals and so on, all of that, in my view, is secondary to this more profound failure to fix the government of the country so that it worked for the people.
Because we're talking here about who will lead the party after Rishi Sunak, but can one person change the party?
Well, we need a leader. We really need leadership. It really does matter who's in charge, but that's not enough. As a party, as a conservative movement, we need to remember what we believe and who we stand for and why we're in this business of politics. And I think there's a big conversation to be had with our party, with MPs and members about our values. And then, yes, you're right. The rest of us, particularly those of us in Parliament, need to get behind the leader and work together.
But with respect, there might be some people, Danny, who think you cannot somehow take out everything that you have done in the past and how you've behaved and how you think and transform into some different human being. So maybe your party needs a whole new generation of people.
Well, that's
how can the public trust older politicians to suddenly do a 360 as to how they've behaved in the past?
Well, I'm backing Robert Jenrick, who is himself a young politician in his early 40s. He stood, he'd been in Parliament for only 10 years, and in the last couple of years, he resigned from Rishi Sunak's government because he didn't feel that the direction we were on was the right one, particularly about migration. So he does represent a break with the recent past. But, you know, listen, we're an ancient political party. We've been around for hundreds of years. In every generation, there has to be renewal. And we need to recognise, as you're suggesting, that serious mistakes were made and we need to present a new face to the country. But we also, in my view, need to do it on the basis of our enduring beliefs as Conservatives. We have an idea of what this country is built on. We have a set of values and principles, which, in my view, are bigger than any single generation. We need to, in a sense, get back to what we really believe, the principles of conservatism, but we need to recognise where we've made mistakes and we need to adapt those principles to the challenges of today and tomorrow. So there's a constant sort of dialogue between the past and the future, which I think we need to get right, and we clearly haven't recently.
You have Robert Jenrick, you have Kemi Badenoch, James Cleverly and Tom Tugendhat. What is it about Robert out of those four which drew your attention?
Yeah, so I think Robert has a number of qualities. First, he's got the right policy position. He's very robust on the issues that caused us to lose this election, most of all migration, fixing the economy, getting the NHS right. So in policy terms, I think he's in the right place and he can help win back particularly those voters who went to reform at this last election. So I think he's got the right policies. He's also got the right personality and temperament. He's a serious, steady, highly professional, highly capable, very hardworking politician who gets on with people. He can build a team, works very well with other people. So I think he's got the temperament and the character. And he presents himself, I think, well as a decent, respectable, you know, ordinary guy. He comes from a humble background. His parents, you know, brought him up very well to have all the right conservative values that I think we should be admiring. So I like him as a man, and I'm impressed with where he's got to in his policy position as well.
In August, he said, if I were an American citizen, I'd be voting for Donald Trump. Does he still believe that?
Well, what he said is that the Conservative Party has a long-standing relationship with the Republican Party in the United States. It's our sister party. They're the Conservatives of the US, and he would always expect to support the Republican candidate. I think that's the right position to take. You know,
That's what he said today to Laura Koonsberg when he was being challenged about supporting Trump in the past. Today, he said, the Conservative Party has strong and historic links to the Republican Party, so it is natural that we would lean towards Republican candidates. It's interesting that he never mentions Donald Trump's name. Is he a supporter of Donald Trump? Does he want Trump to win the election ahead of Kamala Harris?
Well, as he's said then and now, he supports the Republican candidate, who is Donald Trump. So I don't think that's a difficult one. And, you know, it's not really for us to be intervening in other parties, other countries' elections, but we do have this relationship with the Republicans. They're on the same side as us in the sort of ideological divides of the West. So it's natural that we'd be supporting the Republican candidate.
So the man who you want to become leader of the Conservative Party supports a convicted felon who abuses women?
Well, listen, we are supporting the Republican Party and the Republican candidates in the election. I think that's the normal position that we would take as Conservatives in this country.
But what is it about Robert Jenrick that attracts him to a man who has abused women and is a criminal?
Listen, you're asking us to get into the American election and into the personalities there.
I were an American citizen, he said, I would be voting for Donald Trump. He's declared this is it is a test of a leader, isn't it? That you look at what are their values no matter what. So I guess what I'm asking, Danny, is how can a leader of this country support someone, no matter what party they're associated with, who abuse women?
Well, I'm not going to get into the question of Donald Trump's convictions. The fact is, Robert Jenrick has said he'd support the Republican candidate, who is Donald Trump. He is the candidate for the presidency over there. And that's the party that we have our historic links with. And that's the position he's taken. I don't really think there's anything else can be said on the subject, I'm afraid.
In terms of immigration, obviously a huge policy issue throughout the world, actually. And it's right at the heart of that American election. It's been at the heart of ours. It'll continue to be at the heart of politics here. What would Robert Jenrick do differently within your party if he was in charge? What would the policy difference be?
So on illegal migration, the question of the small boats coming across the channel, Robert's view is that we need to have a more robust legal framework to properly deter the people smuggling business. And that means that anybody who arrives here should be detained and deported immediately, either back to their own country or to a safe third country if they can't be returned to their own,
like
to
Rwanda.
Their own country. Like Rwanda, exactly. So he would.
What is different about Robert's policy than Rishi Sunak's?
So Robert and I and a number of other colleagues opposed Rishi's bill because we didn't feel that it had enough protections against claims made by lawyers on behalf of the illegal immigrants using European human rights law. So we would toughen up the protections against those legal claims. We felt that the bill that Rishi passed was still open to claims in court, which is indeed exactly what happened. So we would have a tougher Rwanda policy. And then on your broader question about migration itself, on legal migration.
Sorry, but before we get past that, for me to understand that, Danny, because human rights law would still exist no matter who the new leader of the Conservative Party is. So you say you would toughen up the law, but toughening it up, you would still have the same challenges within human rights legislation that exist right now.
Well,
so how would you get
Parliament
around that?
Parliament is sovereign. So if Parliament says that such and such an event must happen, then it should happen. The difficulty we had with the European Convention on Human Rights is that it was possible for lawyers to say, in fact, no, so and so should not be detained and deported because of a particular human rights claim that they would lodge under the European Convention.
Yep.
We need to be clearer that the European Convention will not apply in the instances where we are trying to deport illegal migrants. Robert and I feel we need to even go further now and actually withdraw from the European Convention and draft our own Bill of Rights. You're absolutely right that human rights will still exist. In fact, human rights have always existed in the British system, in the common law. We think we need to write our own new framework for managing human rights in the context of mass migration and this huge trade in illegal migrants that's occurring now. The European Convention is plainly not working as a way of ensuring we can secure our borders. Yes, we need to have human rights. They need to be written into British statute and policed by the British courts rather than through the European Convention. So that's an example of where we would have a tougher and, I think, a more effective response to the problem of illegal migration.
Here's a snippet of what Robert said today.
Well, firstly, I do want to get the economy growing faster again. I want to reclaim the mantle for the Conservative Party of low tax and pro-growth. But I don't agree that the age of mass migration has made our country richer. You know, in the 25 years since Tony Blair became Prime Minister, we've had 5.9 million people coming into our country legally. It was 59,000 in the 25 years prior to that. And this has not been a period of record growth, record productivity growth. In fact, far from it. I wrote a report earlier in the year that set out that the level of migration and the types of people coming into our country, mm-hmm. which are mostly low-wage, low-skilled people, are actually costing the economy money.
So Robert's idea is that there would be a legally enforceable cap on migration, right?
Yes.
How would that be enforced? Like, what if the Conservative Party broke that cap? What's the point of it being legally enforceable? So it would be a target anyway. What happens to the then Prime Minister, if it would be Robert Jenrick, if the cap is broken? What's the point of it being legally enforceable? How do you legally enforce something against yourselves?
Okay. So what is being proposed is a annual cap set by Parliament, so that's the legally enforceable bit. Parliament would legislate for what the cap on net migration would be. And it would be the job of the Home Office then to ensure that that cap is not exceeded. And the way it does that is by restricting the numbers of visas that are awarded. And Robert, when he was Immigration Minister, significantly reduced the numbers of visas, but we're still in the hundreds of thousands. His view is we need to be getting down to the tens of thousands, and that would be organised through the Home Office visa regime.
But that happens anyway. That happens now, doesn't it?
There's no cap. No, there's no limit on the number of people coming into this country. There's a system of points by which
your party has publicly set targets in the past.
Well, no, actually, what we've said is we've made commitments which we broke. So in previous elections, correct, going back to 2010, we have said as a manifesto commitment, we want to see migration coming down to the tens of thousands. What we didn't do,
correct,
was use Parliament to say this is the number that will be reached each year. We've had an aspiration to reduce it and we failed. And that was a fundamental breach of confidence and trust with the public. So the proposal now, in an attempt to try and rebuild that trust, and it is going to be a long job to do that. I'm not proposing one policy announcement will do it. But what is necessary is to send a clear instruction to the Home Office by Parliament. This is the number of people who will be allowed into the country this year. This is what the economy needs. This is the number that we can accommodate in housing and in public services. This is the number that's appropriate to the needs of the country. That's the limit that should be awarded in terms of visas this year.
Kemi Badenoch has been writing about immigration and said we can't assume that all cultures are equally valid. And Laura Koonsberg asked her which cultures she thinks are less valid. Have a listen.
Lots. Cultures that believe in child marriage, for instance, or that women don't have equal rights. I actually think it's extraordinary that people think that's an unusual or controversial thing to say. Of course, not all cultures are equally valid. I don't believe in cultural relativism. I believe in Western values, the principles which have made this country great. And I think that we need to make sure that we continue to abide by those principles to keep the society that we have now.
Do you agree with Kemi, Danny?
Well, I agree with her about the importance of recognising and upholding the values of this country and of the West. And if people have if people are enforcing views and values which are inconsistent with our own, then there is a problem. And we shouldn't be afraid to say so. And she identified a number of practices and values that are inconsistent with those of our country. And I think it was right for her to suggest that.
Would you work in a cabinet, a shadow cabinet, if she was in charge?
Certainly, if she asked me to.
Are there any of the four candidates you wouldn't work for?
No. And one good thing I think of this process is actually, despite obviously everybody's in competition with each other, actually the conversations that have been being had between the candidates and within the party are constructive, focused on policy, some significant differences, but actually also a remarkable level of agreement about the problem we've got, the breach of trust we had with the public at the last election, and the need to rebuild that through a different sort of politics. So I think actually the party is coming together, and obviously we were very divided in the last parliament and we need to be much more united looking forward.
How much do you think Boris Johnson played a part in breaching the trust between your party and the public?
Well, listen, we all did, and Boris played his part, and, you know, I was very sad.
How much of a part did he play?
I don't know. I can't put a proportion on it, but it was significant. I mean, you know, as I said earlier to you, I think the real problems that for our party were failure to deliver on the NHS, on migration, on the economy. But there was also a significant problem that we had with behaviour, you know, issues of integrity. And I think, you know, I don't want to point fingers, but all of us have our part to play in that. I contributed to the problem by being critical of the government of different, you know, different stages. We were disunited and there were scandals, and all of that contributed to our defeat. But as I say, I think the real problem is it goes deeper.
And if we come full circle back to what we were talking about at the beginning of this conversation, with all of those deep-seated rivalries going on within your party, briefing against each other, fighting with each other, trying to bring each other down, That's hardly been fixed overnight. It's still there, is it not?
Well, as I just said, not as much as it was. And even then, by the way, I think it was exaggerated, your portrayal there. You know, it's appropriate and legitimate for elected politicians to disagree, and to disagree publicly sometimes, even with members of their own party. I mean, what kind of politics do you want in which that doesn't happen? I don't accept that there was, you know, deep, vicious infighting. There was some significant policy differences. I've just
Between Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson, you don't?
Well, even there, I mean, there was some policy differences. And then at the end, it all came crashing down.
About policy.
Really,
that was
unfortunately.
They completely fell out with each other.
Well, they did. I mean, mostly over policy, over the appropriate response to lockdown and the economic approach there. And then more latterly, we had problems with Rishi Sunak on migration, and some of us disagreed with him on that. I think that isn't wrong to have those differences, and even for them to go into the public. But you know, your general point is right. Infighting was an issue. The public were looking at us thinking, you can't agree with each other. Why should you expect us to agree with you? I think that's a real problem. What we need, as I've said, is clarity on what we stand for, what our beliefs are, the direction we're going. That requires leadership. I hope that this process that we're going through now will deliver us a leader who's capable of uniting us, and we're all prepared to follow.
And as you talk about scandals, obviously the present Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, he's hardly got his feet under the table, where he's involved in media scrutiny around the freebies that both he and other Labour Party members have received. Do you and your colleagues in the Conservative Party get freebies in terms of free suits and tickets to Taylor Swift and payment towards your glasses?
No. No. And I mean, listen, let Labour and Keir Starmer defend themselves on that. I do find it.
But are you not at it? Have you ever had a suit bought for you?
No, I haven't had a suit bought. I think I've had one free pair of tickets to a football match in the time I've been a MP. It was donated by a friend, which I declared, as everybody does. But I do think the extent of which Keir's been taking freebies is fairly eye-watering. And it does suggest that the system needs a proper look and further reform.
Like, would you go as far, Danny, to say that it should be as simple as a politician should not take any freebie?
Well, it might be, but how do you actually manage that? Does that, I mean, if you could, can nobody, no friend offer you a, you know, a gift, a pair of tickets to a concert?
Correct.
That's a weekend
in
that
order,
cottage.
In order to keep the thing squeaky clean, would you go that far?
Listen, I think we probably need to have a big look at it, but we also need to be real and practical. But there is obviously a problem when you have people taking freebies on this scale. It brings the whole system into disrepute. It makes people distrust politicians even more than they did already. I do think it's a, you know, it's a real shame that Labour have, you know, as the Tories didn't do great in the last parliament at dragging politics into disrepute, Labour are really, really doing it even worse now. So I'm not surprised the public feeling pretty exasperated with this, and maybe it does really need to have a big look at it.
I guess I'm trying to get a sense from you tonight as to how much is all of this the norm across all of you, across all political parties.
I'm astonished at the extent
to buy their influence.
Well, listen, you've got to ask yourself, how do you think politics should be funded? If you think the taxpayer should pay for it, that's one easy answer. I'm not sure the taxpayer wants to pay for it. If it's not, it's got to be paid for by people who support the party. And then you're asking, you know, what is the motivation for their support and what are they getting for it? And you've got to recognise, for some donors, they are genuinely only interested in creating the kind of country they believe in, and they support the politicians that they believe in. There's nothing in it for them. And that's the system we want. You might, however, ask what's in it for this particular donor who seems to be really, really supporting a whole bunch of politicians. And then you can be cynical about that. And it's very difficult to disentangle the motives of these donors. I'm not sure there's an easy answer. As I say, I don't think taxpayer funding is the answer. I think it is appropriate, and it should be acceptable for people, you or I, to put our hands in our pockets to support a political campaign that we believe in. I mean, the members of the public do that the whole time, supporting campaigns. Obviously, when you're talking about millions of pounds and people who have direct access to the politicians, then the whole question arises, what's going on here? Is there something in it for them beyond simply their belief in the politics of that particular party? It's very difficult to disentangle.
Let me come back to another policy, and Kemi Badenoch again, actually. She says, Danny, that maternity pay has gone too far and the government needs to interfere less in people's lives. She was speaking to Times Radio. Let's have a listen.
Maternity pay varies depending on who you work for, but it is a function, where it's statutory maternity pay, it is a function of tax. Tax comes from people who are working. We're taking from one group of people and giving to another. This, in my view, is excessive. Businesses are closing. Businesses are not starting in the UK because they say that the burden of regulation is too high.
So maternity pay is excessive.
I think it's gone too far the other way in terms of general business regulation. We need to allow businesses, especially small businesses, to make more of their own decisions. The exact amount of maternity pay, in my view, is neither here nor there. We need to make sure that we are creating an environment where people can work and people can have more freedom to make their individual decisions.
Well, it's here nor there for people who can't afford to have a baby, isn't it?
We need to have more personal responsibility.
Is that part of the problem, Danny, within your party? That here you have Kemi saying the actual amount is neither here nor there. It's absolutely here and there if it's a difference between someone being able to afford to have a child.
Yes, and I'm sure she'd recognise that. I think the point she was making when she said it's neither here nor there is she was talking about the general principle that businesses are overregulated and we have a very large welfare bill. My view is, and I think I she'd have to speak for herself, but I think she shares this view, is that we should certainly not be cutting maternity pay. I mean, I think if there's one benefit that could usefully go up, it's that one. It is incredibly hard to afford a family. And I think the government should be supporting people having children in their children's early years. But that's something you'd have to take up with Kemi. I think the general point that the businesses are overregulated, and it's very hard to make a business prosper because of the level of tax and red tape, I think is a point that's very well made.
Okay. Listen, thank you very much for spending so much time with us tonight. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks very much indeed.
All the very best. Bye.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the headlines, I'm John Wilkinson. The US President Joe Biden has said that a regional conflict in the Middle East has to be avoided after Israeli airstrikes killed nearly 50 people in Lebanon and also hit targets in Gaza and Yemen. Lebanon's Prime Minister said a million people may have been forced from their homes by the Israeli bombardment aimed at the Iranian-backed group Hezbollah. The former Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has urged Conservative Party members meeting at their conference in Birmingham to end the squabbling and back whoever is elected as the leader to replace him. The four remaining candidates, Kemi Badenoch, Robert Jenrick, Tom Tugendhat and James Cleverly, will be reduced to two by MPs, with the party membership then choosing the winner. A man in his 60s arrested after the death of an 8-year-old boy from gunshot wounds in Cumbria has been released on bail pending further investigations. Emergency services were called to a farm in the Warcop area yesterday afternoon. The boy died of his injuries overnight. And the far-right Freedom Party is projected to have won Austria's general election, but fallen well short of an outright majority. Forming a coalition is likely to be complicated, as other parties have said they won't go into government with the Freedom Party. Party's leader. Here's your sport. In the Premier League, Tottenham overcame the absence of Son Heung-min to beat Manchester United at Old Trafford this evening. Their 3-0 win made it four victories in a row in all competitions for Spurs. As for United, they had captain Bruno Fernandes sent off at 1-0 down, and it is now their joint worst start in the Premier League after six games. Here's how Chris Sutton assessed it on 5 Live's 6:06 earlier.
Why were they like still in warm-up mode when the game started? That's totally unacceptable. I mean, Ten Hag now has spent over £500 million, third wow. season, and that's Manchester United? Is that what Manchester United fans want, for them to be deemed a cup team? 2 months down the line, 3 months down the line, do you see Ten Hag, he's been there a long time, making a massive improvement? I don't. Mm-hmm.
Aston Villa could have gone joint top of the table, but were held to a 2-2 draw at Ipswich. Rangers won in the Scottish Premiership, beating Hibernian 1-0, whilst in the Women's Super League there were wins for Manchester City, Manchester United and Arsenal. England's cricketers have lost their one-day international series against Australia. Today's match in Bristol was abandoned because of rain, with the tourists well in control in their run chase. The final result was a 49-run win for Australia under DLS. But England's interim head coach in the white ball format, Marcus Trescothick, has been impressed with how Harry Brook has handled the stand-in captaincy.
He sees it well, he reads the game nicely, and I think the way that he's captain on the pitch, some of the field settings and decision-making has been really positive. And, you kind of like the way that he's gone about it within the guys. Quite quiet, unassuming, but just gets the job done, everything you want him to do.
There's much more on the latest TMS podcast on the BBC Sounds app now. In rugby union, England's women have started the defence of their WXV1 title with a 61-21 win against the USA in Vancouver. It was watched by our reporter Sarah Orchard.
A bonus point win and job done, but the scoreline does flatter England, who faced a dogged American side who wouldn't go away, scoring 3 tries of their own. The positives for the Red Roses include a standout performance from Saracens fly half Zoe Harrison, who controlled well in a starting 10 shirt, and a positive debut for Bristol Bears centre Phoebe Murray. But tougher tests are ahead, with world champions New Zealand and host Canada coming up in the next fortnight.
Also in rugby union, Bath beat Leicester by 20-15 in the Premiership. Mark Selby has won snooker's British Open title. And in golf, Keegan Bradley has won the decisive point for the United States to take their 10th President's Cup in a row against the international team in Montreal. That is the latest from BBC Sport, and you can listen on your smart speaker by saying play BBC Sports News.
This is all smoke and mirrors. That's sales.
On BBC iPlayer.
What have you got to offer me?
Look, this is in all of our interests, right?
The new series of Industry.
I'm so glad you came.
Starring Kit Harington.
I'm an investment banker. Did you invite me here to watch you eat?
No, I invited you here to seduce you.
I've never met anyone with a bigger blind spot.
All's fair in love and war, right?
I needed my friend and you used me.
Industry.
Now, we go to work.
Starts Tuesday on BBC iPlayer.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We feel totally betrayed.
Welcome to Murrayfield.
I listen to you guys all the time.
Stephen Nolan.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Thanks for being with me this Sunday night. It's Stephen Nolan. Energy prices are going up this week. From Tuesday, if you live in England, Wales or Scotland, a typical household annual energy bill will go up by 10%. So for every 100 quid you spend in energy now from Tuesday, you'll be paying 110 quid. The cap set by the energy regulator Ofgem affects the price paid for each unit of gas and electricity used in 27 million homes. So the low prices will still be lower than last winter. The rise comes as some support for bills has been withdrawn. The government has announced it will halt winter fuel payments for 10 million pensioners in England and Wales, and the local Stormont Assembly in Northern Ireland has done the same thing. So what can you do to try to make the price increases less of a financial burden? Helen Judney, Complaining Cow Company, and the consumer expert with us this evening. Good evening to you, Helen.
Good evening.
Remind us about this energy price cap, Helen.
Well, it's brought in by Ofgem, which means that energy companies can't charge you any more than that cap. And that's a price per unit, not a total. So electricity will be capped at 24.5p per kilowatt, and gas is capped at 6.24p per kilowatt. So that's what we will be paying come the 1st of October.
And that obviously will cause problems for some people who are already on the edge.
Absolutely. So we need to be looking at, I would advise people to be looking at possible fixed tariffs, because there are a few around. So some energy providers are offering a fixed tariff that's cheaper than the price cap. Some are offering the fixed tariffs to existing customers. Some are offering them to new ones. So you do need to do your research. British Gas removed its fixed tariff offer just last week. So you do need to do it before the October the 1st. So Outfox the Market has got one, but you will have to pay if you cancel it. Octopus Energy's got a good one with no fee for cancellation, so that's quite a low one. But they're both lower than the cap, so they are quite good. Certainly need to do your research. You might be able to find particular ones using cashback sites, and certainly the switching sites, and there might be ones sort of local to your area. So it will take a lot of time, it will take a lot of research, but it could be that you actually save quite a lot of money.
And the fact that they're prepared to fix that below the price cap, does that suggest that they reckon that the prices are going to come down in the future? Is that what they're pricing in?
I don't know. I think it's all, you know, nobody's got that crystal ball. Cornwall Insights, who sort of predict what's usually going to happen with price caps, and that's still actually expect it to rise again in January, which is another reason, you know, it would be good to fix the rate if you can, if that cap's going to go up again in January, because at least then over the months, the winter months when you put your heating on, it's likely to be less. But then it's expected to drop back down again. So I think it's just a case of these companies taking a risk. Also, some companies taking the risk to try and hold on to their customers and retain new customers. So it's all sort of a bit of give and take, really.
And finally, how aggressive are these companies in trying to win customers and keep them?
Well, it's interesting. At the moment, it doesn't seem to be that much. There aren't a lot of companies offering a lot. You know, you think before the energy crisis, we always used to say switch and go switch. And there were always lots and lots of offers. And there certainly were not at that stage again yet at all. So it isn't like it used to be in the good old days when you could find a better tariff. Now you really have to work for it. But there are more signs. There are more signs than there were 6 months and a year ago. So I wouldn't say they are very aggressive at trying to keep customers at the moment. And of course, as we know, in the energy, their customer service is absolutely atrocious. So, you know, you might want to look at records for customer service too.
Helen, thank you very much. Thank you. 20 to 12 this Sunday night. More blasts have been heard in southwest Beirut this evening. It's as Israel continues its attacks on the leadership of Hezbollah. The Iran-backed group has confirmed the death, two more, of its top military figures. It follows the assassination of the leader, Hassan Nasrallah, on Friday night. Oliver McTernan is co-founder and director of Forward Thinking. Hello, Oliver.
Good evening, Stephen.
Well, it doesn't seem, Oliver, like Israel is pulling back. What's your reaction to this news now as well?
I am, and I'm sure many others, Stephen, are deeply, deeply worried about these developments, because, again, we now hear we have 1 million displaced people in Lebanon. And, you know, that's on top of the over 1 million displaced people living in tents in Gaza. So, frankly, it's a deeply worrying development. And likewise, I mean, I'm just focusing on the human situation immediately, the people most affected. But likewise, I fear this is going to escalate unless the Biden administration get a grip on it and stop supplying the means by which Israel is able to carry out these extensive bombing.
And when they claim they're advising citizens where to stay away from, what chance have people got to avoid these areas, Oliver?
Well, you know, it's impossible. It's impossible in Gaza, and it's impossible in Lebanon, in the south of Lebanon. What worries me, Stephen, is, you know, we had post-World War II, out of the horrors of the World War and the abuses of the World War II, we had a rule-based society. And now I fear we're seeing that sort of order just disintegrating before our eyes, because on a daily basis, we're witnessing extrajudicial killing, where the law, what was called lex talionis, the law of proportionality, has just gone out the window. And I don't think that these actions are going to bring Israel the security that it is looking for and has a right to.
So can you give me more of a sense of what people are going through, those ordinary people who they have no decision making in any war. They're trying to keep a family safe and they're trying to stay alive.
I get on a daily basis clips from Gaza, and now they're coming from Lebanon. And it is just horrendous to see the conditions in which people are living, what they're having to cope with, but also the terrible, terrible injuries and you know, the dead bodies strewn over the place. I think we're losing rapidly our sense of humanity. And I was listening yesterday to an interview by one of the American intelligence people who resigned over this. He was the person who was responsible for overseeing weapons shipments, and a man called Harrison Mann. And he talked about why he resigned, is that he was watching industrialized slaughter. Now, I don't think he said that lightly. And what just shocks me is our lack of empathy for, when I say our lack, the global lack of empathy for what's happening to our fellow human beings. Of course, Israel has, you know, every right to expect security like everyone else. But it's, I think we fail to recognize that the leadership certainly is in a very traumatized state and is acting accordingly. And sadly, America is enabling them to do that by supplying the weapons that are being used in these cases.
And in terms of the killing of Nasrallah, how was that information received, that killing received in Israel?
Well, I was there last week, and just as I was leaving, the news of this came out. I think on the one hand, you know, I said the politicians are traumatized. I think the whole society is. But I think there was a mix of people saying, well, you know, he got what he deserved, and others fearful of what, you know, it may lead to. And the sad thing is that the whole plight of the hostages in Gaza now seems to be totally overlooked. And the other thing that I fear is there is certainly in the Knesset widespread support for a ground invasion of southern Lebanon. Now, I think if this happens, the risk, as we say, of a wider conflict in the region, it becomes very, very real.
Let me just read to you and get your reaction. The front page of the Times tomorrow: Israeli tanks at border as Lebanon braces for battle. What could this escalate into, Oliver?
Well, if, you know, as previous, Israel has sent troops into southern Lebanon and even up to Beirut, it hasn't been a good experience in the end. I don't think it's the way to secure the peace and the security for the 60,000 displaced Israelis now in the northern part of the country. And we're told that's the reason for the war. I don't think it'll bring about the sort of security they're lasting. They're looking for. You know, Stephen, it took a long time in Ireland to realise that security wasn't going to be in high walls and more troops on the ground and everything else, but security rests in coming to recognise and come to engage the person you considered your opponent or your enemy, to see them as your fellow human being and someone who you depend on for your security. And I think that's what's desperately needed now, that realization in the region. And I think it is possible.
Do you think a ceasefire, an agreement, is feasible soon?
It's not only feasible, but I think it is essential. But it will not happen, I think, until Biden gets a grip. And he is the one person who, for the past year, has not, I would say, exercised the authority he should have and said, look, you've got to look for a diplomatic solution to these things. At the end of the day, the root of the problem is the ongoing occupation. If you want to solve the Gaza West Bank situation, end occupation. If you want to resolve the Lebanon border dispute, then you have to look at the occupation of the Sheba farms. And we overlook that. That's the only rational way, I think, of dealing with this and bringing to Israel the security that it desires and the peace it desires.
Oliver, thank you very much indeed. Thank you, sir.
Lovely.
10 to midnight, 0808 5 909 693. David's in Derby. Hello, David.
Hi, hey, you okay?
Doing okay, thank you. Go ahead, sir. You're talking about, you're calling us about the politics, the local, the national politics we've been talking about tonight.
Yeah, so earlier on, I heard you had a politician on talking about maternity pay and leave and that it was a burden on business. And this stemmed from Kemi Badenoch's statements earlier on today. I just found that plainly ridiculous. I've got a family of four children now, but 2 4-week-old twins who are just sat next to me right now. And
wow,
the simple
congratulations.
Fact that, yeah,
4 weeks old?
Well, 2 4-week-olds, they're just sat next to me now, and the other two are upstairs asleep. So the
brilliant.
Family's been okay. And it's lovely. Yeah. But the planning and thought that had to go into, particularly this last pregnancy, in terms of finances, given my wife is only entitled to statutory maternity pay, which she's always been with any job she's had. She's never had an entitlement beyond that. And I think that in lived experience seems to be for the vast majority of people, you know, there aren't a great many people out there who have been able to turn around to their employers and say, no, I want more than statutory, unless they really have influence within their job. And that seems to, you know, limit heavily people going back to work or being able to go back to work. I mean, we were looking at a position now where if our daughters were born 2 days later this time round, my wife could have gone back to work 3 months earlier with us being financially the same. The fact they were born 2 days before would have put us £1,600 out of pocket, and therefore she's had to take 12 months off with 3 months unpaid at the end of it.
And of course, according to Kemi Badenoch, who could be the next leader of the Conservative Party, let's see, it's neither here nor there how much maternity pay someone gets.
Like I say, in our situation in particular, it's ridiculous. Don't get me wrong. Actually, we are okay. You know, we're not, I wouldn't say we're massively struggling along, but what my wife was entitled to in terms of maternity pay at statutory formed a big part of how we planned the next 12 months, because we had to have that discussion before we decided to have a third child that turned out to be third and fourth about, you know, can we afford it? We decided, yes, we can, and yes, we can. But, like I say, she previously went back to work after 9 months maternity and forgoed the 3 months unpaid to go back to work, you know, and carry on earning a living. That just wasn't financially viable this time around. And to say that, oh, it's neither here nor there, that it doesn't really matter, that, oh, people, businesses can choose to decide whether to offer more, to retract. I don't think that equates down to your everyday person who works in areas like retail or hospitality or, you know, anywhere that's not, doesn't have workplace benefits. You end up really having to look at what you get the bare minimum of and deciding, actually, can I have a family?
Well, listen, it's a beautiful thought you've got. I think I can hear the kids in the background, the two little twins there, 4 weeks
well,
old.
Well, one of them's hiccuping away and the other one's chugging a bottle. So.
Okay. I'll let you get back to that then, but thanks for calling us tonight, David.
Thank you very much for speaking to me. Cheers.
Thank you. Let's talk about the world of flight etiquette now. We know the safety rules. Not everyone knows the unwritten rules of travelling. When the cabin lights dim for takeoff, are you that person who immediately flips the reading light on? Let's talk to the flight etiquette expert, Lisa Francesca Nan, travel journalist, host of the Big Travel podcast. Hello, Lisa.
Hello there.
Well, look, if you're allowed to do it, you know, I'm of the view, do it.
No,
if you're not allowed to
do
it, you shouldn't be able to do it.
You and I would fight on an aeroplane.
Well,
not really. But why
are you able to do it if you shouldn't do it?
Well, there are a lot of places.
What's all this
etiquette
malarkey rather than what are the rules?
I think it's not really a case of etiquette. It's a case of thinking of your other passenger. And the problem is, it's not whether, you know, you and I are on different sides of the reclining argument, but the fact is that the airlines are to blame because there's just not enough room for anyone, you know, and seats are tiny and they've got smaller and smaller as the years have gone by. And, you know, there's a lot of pressure when people are flying. You know, it's quite a high pressured environment in many, many ways. And I personally would say, and there is a bit of a rule sort of online, that unless your flight is over 4 hours, then if your seat reclines, don't recline your seat, because it just really inconveniences and make the person behind and makes the flight very,
so why
very
is there
uncomfortable.
So why is there a reclining seat then?
Well, actually, on the newer airlines, they don't really have, a lot of them don't have reclining seats now, which is good. But in the US, they still have a lot of reclining seats. And the Americans are sort of more lenient about it. You know, they think that it's okay to recline your seat. But, you know, there's very, very little room, like, especially if you've got your laptop out or if you're eating food and got your tray down. I think just be considerate. You know, other bugbears, you've got the you know, who puts their elbow on the armrest. I had one recently.
What's the etiquette around that?
Well, I think, again, I had this awful flight once where this man who was just like a geography teacher, not that, you know, I love geography, I'm a travel expert, but he had like this big fleecy jumper on and we were on a 9-hour flight somewhere, and he took off his jumper and lay it over the armrest between us and said, oh, that's going to make it more comfortable for us. And I was like, I do not want to share your jumper, you know. And and so he hogged the armrest. And I think that's a little bit mean as well, you know, particularly for somebody sitting in the middle seat. So my opinion on the etiquette is if you're sitting on the aisle seat, just have your aisle armrest, and if you're sitting on the window seat, have that one and leave the middle ones to the poor person who's squashed into the middle seat. That's my etiquette rules on it.
And if you need to go to the toilet and there's someone sleeping beside you, do you climb over them or do you waken them up?
Just wear a nappy. No, that's not, obviously that doesn't work. Just don't go. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you really have to go to the toilet, you really have to go to the toilet. And yeah, I suppose climb over them is, it might give them a little surprise if they wake up and you're sort of like, you know, straddling them on the way to the loo. Maybe just say a polite sort of excuse me. But, you know, it is a high pressured situation. Like everyone gets a little bit more tense when they're, you know, flying and, you know, it's quite an arduous task for some people going to the airport, you know, doing all your luggage, getting on the plane, being in a tightly packed aeroplane like that. So I think my general advice is just be a little bit considerate of people if you can.
I was in America last week, flan over, flan back, and these two people who were sitting beside me, the inane chat between the two of them. So they didn't know each other when they got on the plane. And they talked non-stop, giving each other this life story. And it completely did my head in. Like, it was terrible. Why do people not just get on, put the wee headphones on, watch a movie? And this man would not shut up, telling this woman, who would not shut up either, about each other's lives. I don't care.
I think it's it depends what they've got passenger? To say. If they were interesting, it might be quite nice to sort of eavesdrop. Oh. And I've met some very interesting people on the flight. I can go on worse than that, though. Recently, I was on a flight where I did have the misfortune of being in the middle seat. And the people that were sitting on either side of me were together. So they had booked a trying to think,
we'll
get away with it. Well, exactly.
You should have moved. Booked,
well, I couldn't. They wouldn't let me, you know. And because one wanted the aisle and one wanted the window. And I was stuck in the middle and they kept passing things between them with me in the middle. I mean, that was even worse,
Lisa, thank you very much. Nice to talk to you. Here comes the midnight.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at midnight. This is Simon English. Within the past few minutes, it's been announced that the American singer, songwriter and actor Kris Kristofferson has died at the age of 88. He was known for the songs Me and Bobby McGee and Help Me Make It Through the Night. As an actor, he starred in Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid and A Star is Born. President Biden has made a plea for all-out war in the Middle East to be avoided. He was speaking after Israel continued its bombardment of targets in Lebanon with airstrikes on the capital Beirut and areas in the south and northeast. Lebanon's health ministry said more than 50 people were killed. Israel says it's hit more than 120 targets of the militant group Hezbollah since killing its leader on Friday. Firas Magsad, an expert from the Middle East Institute, says Israel has long-term aims.
This is a campaign to reshape the balance of power in Lebanon and in the Levant. And Israel has landed some very significant blows in what is the first round of a 12-round match between it and Iran here.
The former Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has urged the Conservative Party to stop squabbling and back whoever they choose as their next leader. All four candidates, Kemi Badenoch, Robert Jenrick, James Cleverly and Tom Tugendhat, held hustings this evening. Reem Ibrahim from the free market think tank, the Institute of Economic Affairs, says the atmosphere in Birmingham is surprisingly upbeat given the Conservatives' huge electoral loss.
There's a lot of discussions about what the Conservative Party should stand for, what the ideology should look like, what the principles, what does it mean to be a Conservative? And of course, all of these debates are occurring not just on the main stage, but at fringe events. Members are discussing it, and it feels like there's hype and there's sort of, I suppose, notion of hope.
Police have released on bail a man they arrested after the death of an 8-year-old boy from gunshot wounds in Cumbria. Officers were called to a farm in Warcop yesterday afternoon. The child was taken to hospital but died overnight. The far-right Freedom Party is heading for an unprecedented general election victory in Austria. Projections give it about 29% of the vote, but no outright majority.